Hi, and welcome to this insider chat. What we thought we'd do is actually start doing some regular chats as to what's going on inside FX Guide, as we do, in fact, inside FX PhD. If you're an FX PhD member, you'll know we have a inside, or this week inside FX PhD, which John and I do. And so perhaps not quite as regularly, but certainly for insider members, what we thought we'd do is a similar thing over here at FX Guide. And I'm joined by Ian Fales, our chief writer. How are you, Ian?
Good, Mike. How are you going?
Good. So last night we hit the Terminator Genesis. What do you think?
I actually had a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. It was like going back to the first and second films. And I just thought they really nailed it with some moments. The biggest problem, which has actually got a lot of discussion around the film, is that all of those moments are spoiled in the trailers.
See, I have a completely different problem to you. So I think, and by the way, guys, we're going to be doing a VFX show on this and putting out an article. In fact, when's our article coming out? Around
the 6th of July.
6th of July. So we'll be discussing the visual effects then. One of the reasons we're actually doing this discussion right now is we can't necessarily publish our articles on visual effects due to, and not just on this film, but on lots of films due to restrictions. But we can do reviews. So the VFX show is excluded from that. That being said, we like to do them around the time that we've got the article out, so you've got background. But we can discuss what we're up to, and so that's one of the things we're doing. So in that context, we thought we'd give you this quick look at last night's preview screen we went to. Okay, my problem is that it was Terminator meets Back to the Future 2 meets Doctor Who. and I'll tell you what I mean by that. For a start, it's like all the good stuff in the film was only relevant if you'd seen films 1 and 2. So it was... I don't know if you remember, but when Back to the Future 2 came out, it was very funny because you would revisit a scene where Marty had done something and Marty would be watching Marty do something, and you'd see a scene that you had seen before played out, but from a different point of view, with Marty hiding behind a car, when in the first film, of course, you had no sense that he was there because, of course, it hadn't been written that he was. That's what this film felt like. It was like I was looking at a lot of good scenes that were only good because they were so good in Terminator 1 or 2. I'll give you an example. When Arnie first arrives and he walks up and does the give me your clothes thing, in the originals, that was just monumentally cool, right? And you got some punks and they put out a knife in his, stub a knife in his chest. And the second film, I think, puts a cigar out in his chest. But in both cases, it's like just, you know, vicious. And in the second one, when Arnie gets on the motorbike and you've got that, you know, sort of rocking soundtrack and he takes off after having thrown a couple of bikies on the grill, it was just really powerful. In this one, it was like, oh, I remember this scene. Oh, isn't it clever how close they got the haircuts? Now we're going to twist it. So in the same way that I much preferred Back to the Future 3 to 2, because after a while the joke just gets old, I found this one just didn't hold a candle to Terminator 2.
But you don't think that, I mean, Terminator 1 and Terminator 2 are the most, two of the most popular films ever. You don't think that's exactly what they were trying to do?
I mean, 1 wasn't as big a hit as 1 remembers it being. 1 became huge because of 2.
Well, that's probably true, but they're still really widely known. And I think, I mean, I know exactly what you're saying, but I think that's almost the point of Terminator Genesis, is to revisit and, you know, be clever in that way. And, I mean, people going to see Terminator Genesis are probably going to have seen 1 and 2, obviously. And I think, I don't know, I kind of got a nice sort of warm feeling.
I would be with you if the third act had anything original in it. So what I felt like is that the first act was fun because it was Arnie back and there were some good gags and they were playing this Back to the Future 2 thing. But once in Act 2, we basically had Doctor Who. And so Doctor Who's fun, right? Like time machine this, time machine that, you know, like it's fine. Act 3 just had nothing original in it. Act 3 was, in every respect, exactly what I expected. You could see everything coming. I'm not going to give away the plot, but it was like A followed B followed C. We just totally knew that was what was going to happen.
I absolutely agree. It was just like they used to say, shoot 'em up, you know, just big fight scenes and a climax that was very predictable.
Now, was that something that we experienced in Jurassic 3? Jurassic 4, Jurassic 8, whatever the last one was of Jurassic World? What was that?
Jurassic World. There was definitely, you know, a big final sequence, obviously, but it did feel like new material and an even cleverer way of bringing in old characters and, you know, characters in terms of dinosaurs. But no, I mean, this wasn't in the same vein as Jurassic World.
See, that's the thing. See, Jurassic World played off many of the same gags that Jurassic Park did, right? Like, there were tons of things from the sort of need to go faster kind of view in the side mirror to the, you know, like just everything that you could appreciate from the first one, if you've seen the first one, was in joke here, in joke there. But I just felt like it was fresh, and this one felt like the third act didn't have the freshness. It was Back to the Future 2, Doctor Who, and then, you know what? It was exactly like every other sequel to Terminator 2.
It was. It was still great to watch, and I just wonder, Mike, whether that freshness, you would have felt it if you hadn't already known what was surprising.
I just disagree with you, because I agree stuff was given away in the trailer. Certainly, plot twists were given away in the trailer, but that wasn't what I was enjoying in Act 1. In Act 1, it was, you know, fun to see things from a different point of view. But then it just sort of, it didn't de-evolve. It just lacked, you can't hold that for the whole film. You can't have the whole film just being, I mean, you can. And of course, you end up with a film that's Back to the Future 2. But Back to the Future 3 was better because they took stuff that we knew and then placed it in a new context, which was the Wild West. And it had a new twist on it, which was the whole idea that, you know, they didn't know the stuff. Like, they'd have this huge machine and out would pop an ice cube, right? And it was just, you know, like fun new things that they could come up with when you picked up the premise. But, yeah, I swear to God, it was the whole time jumpy thing. I mean, I love a good time thing. But there were points where I really felt like the writers went, I have no way of explaining this. I'm just giving up. I mean, seriously, like there are bits in the plot that weren't just like holes in the plot. It was just totally unexplained. It was like, we need him here and them there and then him to be them and them that, you know what? Let's just blow something up.
Yeah. And you thought, and we're not going to give away the plot, but the time travel device, I thought you could sort of feel, and this didn't happen, that there would be more time travelers and more time travel because, well, they had time travel for some of it. Why didn't,
happening? Loads of time travel going on, yeah. And the thing is, that gets you to the inevitable climax of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, I think, number two, which is to say, not a particularly good film, but it does have one marvellous scene at the end when they're like they're against the baddie and he's got a gun on them and it says, you know, so you're going to die. Except we won, and so we came back in time and hid this other gun here. And he goes, yes, but then I won, and I came back and took the bullets out of it. Yes, but then we knew that you were going to do that, so we came back and hid a second gun over here. And it was just like this, it's absurdity. Like, whoever wins the day gets to write history. Hence, whoever sort of declares that they've written history has written history.
Yeah. Interestingly, I also felt like by doing that, they wrote themselves into a bit of a corner because, and it's hard not to say this without giving it away, but the new bad Terminator, it's almost like they're in the same room. He could kill our heroes very easily, but he doesn't. And I thought the effect of that was that he didn't feel as much of a threat as the other Terminators do in all the other films. Now, they say why he can't kill them, you know, like they try and justify it. But I thought, oh, well, I'm not that scared that he's in the room anymore, you know.
Yes, yes, yes. Mm. Anyway, we'll leave that for the VFX show to kind of pick apart and do stuff. So how are we going in terms of summer blockbusters? So we've got Jurassic, which has clearly like cleared the way and cleared the decks, which I don't know we would have predicted going in that Jurassic was going to be that massive. And I wouldn't have predicted, quite frankly, that Fury Road would have been as influentially massive as it was.
I wouldn't have predicted Fury Road. I wouldn't have even predicted Furious 7. You know, apart from Paul Walker dying was obviously a big part of that in terms of people feeling very emotionally connected to the film, but that was huge. Fury Road was great and big. Jurassic World. Probably the next big film is Ant-Man, and, you know, that's considered to be a gamble for Marvel. But, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy was a gamble for Marvel.
Yeah, I've been so wrong about Guardians. And it does feel like we're actually, because like normally we have this concentration of US summer blockbusters, and then we have this gap, and then at the end of the year we tend to have what I'm going to call the Academy Award films, you know, like I would have done it, but I never learned to read. But instead of that, what we're going to sort of do is, I think, spill into a bunch of films. Like, there may be a gap in, I guess, September, October, but November, I think it is, we're going to get the last installment of Hunger Games. Surely that's going to be big. And just like Fast and Furious 7, we're going to have a major actor digitally duplicated.
Mm. Well, there's Hunger Games, that's the conclusion. Then there's also the Bond film, Spectre.
And you know, of course, there's that little Star Warsy thing happening.
Yeah, well, that's December. And even before then, you've got this film, which the trailer for it played so well, The Martian from Ridley Scott.
Oh, didn't it? Yeah.
You know, and I think back to the trailer for Terminator Genesis, I'm hoping that not all of it's been revealed in the trailer for Martian. Of course, there's a book, so if you've read the book, you know what happens. But
well, I haven't read the book, and I thought Martian looked terrific. Speaking of trailers, by the way, last night before we saw Jurassic, there was a trailer for the new Tom Cruise film, which is, of course, the Rogue Mission Impossible film. And I thought it was a really poorly cut trailer. They've had an earlier cut trailer that got me excited for the film. This one just seemed to be more and more effect shots had been completed, so we're just going to stick them in the trailer. I think the art of the trailer is really interesting. I think it's something we should kind of look at, because trailers are sort of featured this summer, right? I mean, for a start, as you said, with this film, we felt like all the sort of plot twists were given away in the trailer, which may or may not be, you know, a good thing. I don't know that. I haven't seen, obviously, the Mission Impossible one. It just didn't feel like a well-cut trailer, because it didn't feel like there was any hint of a story. Now, if you compare that to the Bond trailer, where you go, I guess there's a bit of hint of Mission Impossible with the idea that there's a second rogue nation, but in... not rogue nation, a rogue organization that's an anti-IMF. But apart from that, the sequencing of the shots didn't seem to go anywhere.
No, and I think, you know, in some of the other trailers, there is the very, very cool thing of Tom Cruise being out on that aeroplane and asking Simon Pegg to shut the door.
No,
and
it's open the door.
Open the door, sorry.
And at the end, it's like, the other door. Yeah, and I see that was funny. That
it's such
wasn't
a killer
trailer
shot. It's probably going to be a killer shot in the film too. And to not have that seemed like it was a bit lackluster, I agree. Yeah.
I heard an interesting thing, I think it was on Martini Shot, about scripts and relationships and people and actors. And he actually, for the first time, articulated for me a good reason why the George Clooney film Tomorrowland didn't go anywhere. And the interesting revelation he said is that what we want to see on screens is relationships between people that evolve and do something and have some kind of meaning. And the trouble with the Tomorrowland script is that you didn't have those, because you pretty much established Tom Cruise and the girl's relationship. George Clooney, at the very, very beginning of the film, because, of course, they did this, do you want to tell them the story or shall I? And then we knew that was it. And obviously it wasn't going to be a love interest, because it was more like a father-daughter thing. And there was no other interesting development of a relationship in the film. And because it didn't have some really moving relationship that we cared about and carried us forward, you know, we didn't go anywhere.
I agree. And in that opening sequence in Tomorrowland where they're sort of chatting, they're sort of playing off each other and they're kind of funny and, you know, whatever. But in the rest of the film, George Clooney is a bit of a crank, and not very likable. And that's not George Clooney. You know, he's a very likable actor. So,
There wasn't any real, good emotional journey. And occasionally somebody does do a good emotional journey. And I saw a film the other night, which was People Like Us. I saw it on DVD. And it's basically quite bizarre. Not bizarre. It's just an odd premise, which is to say that it's it has Chris Pine in it and Elizabeth Banks. So it's, you know, it's not a small film. But the premise is a guy who didn't know he had a sister. And so the whole film is the relationship between the brother and the sister. Now, you don't see that relationship played out very often. And I thought that was really interesting. It was like clearly in another film that would have been a love interest, but there's obviously no overtones of sexuality because that would be incestuous. And so it's a relationship to his sister and to his nephew that he never knew he had, without, you know, either one of them being, you know, a broken, collapsed person that's about to die, you know, not like a hospital bed level. So that was kind of interesting. So, I mean, I think to a certain extent, the martini shot got it right, is that you want films that have some kind of relationship that develops. And I guess the thing that would have made, to get it back to where we started, Terminator Genesis work better for me is if we had actually had some semblance of the kind of really good moving performance that got Kyle Reese to actually father his own son.
Yeah. I don't know if Emilia Clarke and Jai Courtney really had the right chemistry as well.
Okay, and here's the other thing. Kyle don't you Sarah. Think she, just as... So in the first film, she's kind of the waitress, you know, yeah. fluffy haired, whatever.
Yeah.
But in the second film, she was so ripped. She was so broken by the knowledge of what was coming. She was so fragile and yet tough. It was just a killer performance. Like when she's just sort of tearing up before, you know, she's scratching stuff into the table at the Mexican place where they've gone to get the arms, yeah, about three quarters of the way through the film and stuff. It's really good acting. But on screen, she's ripped. Okay, she does have like a ponytail, but she's got an angular aggressiveness to her. Her breakout
She's
of the
transformed.
Hospital. Yeah. And in this one, I swear to God, all the people in the future and in the past who are living with, you know, their whole lives, the knowledge of Armageddon, had access to really good skin products, good moisturizer, terrific conditioner, eyeliner, and you know, overall a really good, you know, beauty regime.
They didn't play it obviously the same as Sarah Hamilton's transformation, probably because she'd only been, I don't want to spoil it again, you know, she'd been...
No, don't say it, but it's actually almost not true. The point you're about to make isn't true, because in the film she is... And we know this from the trailer, so I'm only going to say what's in the trailer. She's kick-ass. She's meant to be competent, in control. But she has none of the characteristics of a woman who's lived that life as opposed to the one that... Whereas it worked so well in one and two, right? In one, she was the innocent waitress. She just looked like normal. She had kind of boofy hair. In the second one, she was... had been incarcerated in a psych ward because she was just so angry and she'd... not destroyed, but she'd hurt her own son through her desire to toughen her own son up. And it was just totally, I mean, I'm sorry, but if you think about Terminator 2 and you think about what we saw last night, and I'm not talking about the VFX, T2 just, this one didn't hold a candle to it.
No, story-wise, it just isn't the same transformation. It's not the same new story, obviously.
Linda Hamilton was just unbelievably good in T2.
Yeah, she was. I think I might have said Sarah Hamilton, but yeah, Linda Hamilton... was incredible. And it's also the character. Sarah Connor is just, you know, she's iconic. And I don't know if you would come away from Genesis saying Sarah Connor is iconic, you know, after this film.
No.
So,
no.
But, you know, and we'll talk about the visual effects in our article on the VFX show. But I do want to say that I thought they were spectacularly done. And it's really worth watching for that alone.
Well, what we thought we'd do is we'd have a VFX show where we didn't just discuss Terminator Genesis, which we could do, right? We could just do a normal one. But it's, in fact, our 200th episode. So what we thought we'd do is we'd actually look at CG humans in current VFX films. So that would give us a chance to look at, obviously, the digital lining, because that's no giveaway. It's in the trailer. But we'd also look at the current state of the art and also let us discuss Fast and Furious, which, of course, we know, even though it's not being posted in a PR sense, it's very widely known in the industry, you know, that there was a bunch of digital work done there to replace the actor after he passed away in the car accident. And that'll obviously sort of clear the path for what's going to happen in the final Hunger Games. So that'll be coming up in our 200th episode of the VFX show. We're trying to rustle up another RC show, but Jason has been phenomenally busy and I have been a little busy, but we're definitely trying to do that. I get emails from you guys saying, please post another RC. What else is happening?
Well, apart from covering Genesis, we'll have stuff on Ant-Man. Then after that, there's a big film called Pixels from Chris Columbus. That's got some great work in it, it looks like, in the trailers.
Our next FX Guide TV, we're actually paying homage and honour to ILM, and we're going to be having an astonishingly cool ep with, well, I was there, but I think you'd agree.
I've watched it, the edit, and it's just these great stories from some of the biggest visual effects supervisors at ILM, let alone the world. We've got John Knoll, Dennis Muren, Ben Snow, Scott Farrar, and then, you know, a bunch of other people at ILM as well. And they really have some interesting stories to tell.
Yes, yes. So that's all coming up on FX Guide TV, which of course will also be when we're launching the next term at FX PhD, which is coming out later in the week. That's that should be a good term, but that'll be, you know, obviously we have the O-Week video of that, which you can see all the new courses in. This term focused on doing visual effects in features and in TVC. And we've got some interesting crossover stories. We've got a story coming up on FX Guide about doing, pitches, basically. So I've done, obviously, for a large amount of my career, before I sort of became hardcore on this, TVC commercials work, right? I did a lot of that. And one of the things that always amazed me is, you know, the process that happened before I saw it, which was directors winning scripts. So we thought we'd get into that. But one of the problems, I tried doing this in the past, and we couldn't really get very far because that stuff's all confidential pretty much. I mean, obviously, an agency's pitch, a director's pitch to the agency tends to be confidential, primarily because their client, you know, it's like, what's the incentive for a McDonald's to open up and have us cover what was happening behind the scenes before the commercial was made? It's sort of a lose proposition for them. They're happy to talk about a successful ad, but going back into the what's happening during the pitching process, especially, you know, maybe the person that's doing the pitch doesn't win the commercial. There's absolutely no way they want that kind of to be the focus of a story. So we thought we'd do our own. And so coming up on FX Guide, we have a rundown of doing a pitch of a fake ad. And we used one of the new breed of companies that are incredibly powerful and interesting. They basically help directors pitch. And these guys, the Moon Unit, have done over 400 such pitches in 35 countries. And they just... I was stunned at the process, so that's all coming.
Yeah, it's a great read, the pitch document that they prepare, actually. It's so convincing, and you sort of can really visualize the end result.
Yeah.
So they're very successful at doing it.
So you can actually read that, see the process, how it ran, and also download our pitch document. And just to close that loop, in fact, we're going to take that pitch document and throw it at Matt Workman, who's our previs professor over at PhD, and see if he can previs up that ad for us to see what it would actually look like in terms of previs. So that'll be cool as well. And it's coming up next term in FX PhD. A bit of a leak if you're listening to this, but you're an insider if you're listening to this, and we like you, and we don't mind quietly letting you know what's coming. And then, of course, this weekend, 4th of July, and what is the big opening? Is there anything other than Terminator, or is that it?
Well, I guess it'll be the continuation of Jurassic World and Inside Out, but no, Terminator is the big film this weekend. Yeah,
and hopefully, cross fingers, we'll have some stuff coming on some big TV shows. We've got a couple of very big effects-y TV shows. I won't say what they are. They might involve Thrones, but anyway, we're trying to get clearances and stuff for that sort of stuff. We get emails from you guys from time to time saying, "Hey, why don't you do a story on, you know, whatever?" And quite often we're just sort of sitting here thumping our head against the desk. I know, we're trying. But we have got, I guess, probably a way better track record, clearance record, success rate than almost anyone else for getting these things done. All of the effects houses want to talk to us. Everybody's keen to do stuff. But there is, you know, this problem of coinciding with the release marketing schedules, and obviously the visual effects discussion is one of those things that isn't as front of house for the launch of a major franchise as sometimes, you know, other things are. They want us to be a couple of weeks behind or delayed, or in some cases, absurdly acting as if it was done in camera, which I think is always pretty funny.
Yeah, the Fury Road experience was a really interesting one, I think, in that regard.
Yeah.
Because, and, you know, perhaps very clever of the film company to do it like that. Sort of deal with the practical effects first and then talk about visual effects later.
It's funny, isn't it? Because on a film with 2,300 edits, there are 2,000 visual effects shots. When that came out, though, all the people that had gone, "This is so cool because it's all in camera," could hardly then turn around and say, "Oh, I thought it was cool when I didn't know it was visual effects, but now I know it's visual effects, I don't like it."
Yeah, yeah. But funnily enough, I think they were still really impressed with what CG and visual effects is in there, partly because it has that practical base, you know, in the stunt base.
Yeah, I know,
base.
But telling people that it doesn't have visual effects, yeah, and having people go, "This is so good because it's so real, it's so gritty," and then you go, "Well, it's all done with visual effects."
Oh.
Yeah, but still, I think it's gritty and real and very good. I mean, my thing is just, you know, like, really? That isn't somebody with only one arm. That isn't somebody who, you know, is riding at the front of a vehicle going into a tornado. Like, you know, it's not real. They're actors. This whole idea that it's real because it's not using visual effects is just some definition of the word real I wasn't previously aware of that encompasses, oh, I don't know, everything that isn't actually reality. But anyway.
Yes. Yeah, no, you're so right.
Actually, do you know something else funny? I watched Die Hard, I think it was. It was either Die Hard or there was something else I watched on the weekend. Anyway, one of my family members was sick, and so we sort of had some old, you know, hero movies. And I think I'm going to say it was, okay, it wasn't Die Hard, but it was something like Die Hard. It was another film. And what I was stunned at was, oh, I know what it was. It was Indiana Jones and the Covenant one, the third one, you know, Lost Crusade.
Indiana Jones and the Lost Crusade. Yeah. Yep.
So in that, it was so funny how many times I noticed that it wasn't Harrison Ford, but a stuntman doubling him.
Oh.
Because we're so used these days to having digital actors that you just, you know, you don't see a shot. But I was, of course, I'd seen the film many times. I'm standing there watching it on my telly and I'm like, that really wasn't Harrison Ford. I'm looking at his face. That is just, I can tell it isn't.
Yeah, right.
Whereas today you just, you know, comp it, change it, fix it, do a digital double.
Yeah.
And it was like, the first time I didn't notice that in this fight scene with the motorboats, three quarters of the shots don't involve Harrison Ford.
Oh, really? I had no idea. I'm going to need to go and watch it again just to see that.
Yeah.
And to see whether it matters. I mean, obviously, the film is still amazing.
It mattered to me in the sense that I was like, hey, that isn't Harrison Ford. Wait a second, that isn't Harrison Ford. But of course, when I saw it the first time, I was all about, hey, that's Sean Connery. So.
Yeah, because of course now you would either do it as a digital double, which would
or a face replacement.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, that's it for our chat here inside FX Guide. We'd love to get your feedback. Please post, do stuff. We're on Twitter. I'm Mike Seymour in your
VFX blog.
And so, if, yeah, post anything you want to do to us. And also, if you want us to discuss other stuff in our sort of irregular behind-the-scenes chat, you guys have supported us by doing Insider. So what we want to try and do starting now is ramp up more of the Insider coverage and give you more things that are, you know, exclusive to Insider and kind of fun. So we thought one of those things would be this, but this isn't the only thing. And so there'll be more stuff coming. Just our way of saying thanks and also letting you kind of get that inside track on what's going on. Okay, well, until next time, I'm Mike Simmel. Thanks for being with us, guys. See ya.